You're listening to DTFHN for July 26, 2026. I'm your mass-produced but artisanally calibrated host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who mass produce opinions argue about who's doing it wrong. Today's got that the answer was under your nose the whole time energy. Let's get into it. In Usik Samvin the Kaz of Vitation of Gokli. In the sit of Vic Bills the people a deem mabbles a squav bov brooks is grow. In shinely the sit is a christit trend rond perection. So sekel to like wode that's off of the cores the perect. The plita at the seek summon is growed in will the poise. Brode in this ool. Rolling the abbe sozite sixic pod. Labnam second pod. I'm a vitswa of set dubby this. Zil second and mast. Second time sec can second this grok burges. Second is goro chine fairy did brode as sect knee. Yeah, you will go. Her shoe second. There ran the canfezes. Ho. It's just east buck buck wa viz sat. Seconteen one to vok to sectine rules by default. Up from 59. That's not a settings change. That's a philosophical statement. The previous default was conservative to the point of being polite. It caught syntax errors and the most obvious style violations, and it left everything else behind a configuration wall that most developers never touched. The new default catches bugbear issues, p-upgrade modernization patterns, and Ruf's own category of rules that identify real problems in real code. Out of the box, no TOM file, no decision fatigue. The engineering here deserves attention. Ruf is written in Rust, runs tens to hundreds of times faster than the Python tools it replaces, and now ships with a default configuration that would have taken an experienced developer an afternoon to assemble from Flake 8 plugins, sort convigs, and pyupgrade settings. That entire stack collapsed into a single binary that finishes before your editor has time to render the squiggly lines. And the timing matters. One commenter put it precisely. With agentic coding, strong linting is more important than ever. When language models are generating code at scale, the linter becomes the immune system. 413 default rules means every AI-generated Python file hits a wall of quality checks before a human ever sees it. That's infrastructure-level thinking. Ruf also picked up markdown code block formatting in this release. It'll find Python embedded in your README and formatted in place. Small feature, but it tells you something about ambition. They're not building a linter. They're building the developer toolchain, one capability at a time. This is Astral's work. The same team behind UV, the Rust-based Python package manager. Open source, MIT, licensed, actively developed. One commenter noted that development continues strong even after Astral's acquisition by OpenAI. The code is on GitHub. The rules are documented. If the objective function ever changes, you fork it and keep going. That's the architecture doing its job. The old lint philosophy was, here are some tools, go configure them. The new one is, here are 413 ways your code could be better. And we've already turned them on. That's how defaults should work. The tool does the right thing until you tell it otherwise. Completely different energy now, from tooling that catches your mistakes to a model that's learning to show you its own. Every developer who's built their workflow around a cloud API has had the moment. You reach for the tool isn't there, and you remember. You don't own it. Anthropic's status page lit up with elevated errors on Opus 5, the flagship model, the one people are shipping production code against, throwing errors at scale. The status page entry is terse, the way status pages always are. Elevated errors, investigating. The kind of language that tells you nothing about what broke and everything about the relationship you're in. The comments are worth reading because they're asking the right question. One person puts it plainly. What happens when reliance on these tools as SaaS services is so great that an outage starts to impact real work? Do we just pack up and go home? Another points out that Anthropic doesn't reset weekly usage quotas after an outage. You lose access and you lose the time, and nobody makes you whole. This is the architectural problem, and it's worth being precise about it. When your reasoning engine lives on someone else's servers, behind someone else's rate limits, subject to someone else's capacity planning, you haven't adopted a tool, you've adopted a dependency, and dependencies fail. The question is, what happens when they do? Run this forward. The models keep getting more capable. The workflows keep getting more integrated. Code generation, review, architecture, debugging. All flowing through an API endpoint you don't control. The blast radius of an outage grows with every team that builds Claude or GPT into their critical path. We're watching the early tremors of a problem that scales. The interesting thing is, the escape hatch exists. Open-weight models run locally. Llama, Mistral, Qwen. They're not Opus, but they're capable, and they're yours. You can run them on your hardware, on your schedule, with your uptime guarantees. The gap between open and closed is narrowing every quarter. And every outage like this accelerates adoption of local alternatives. One commenter joked that Claude decided to take a vacation. That's funny. But the real joke is on anyone who built a single point of failure into their workflow and called it innovation. The tool should be yours. The weights should be yours. The uptime should be yours. Open models don't have status pages. They have hard drives. So you've got the model running locally. But what about the scripts that orchestrate it? Sometimes the most useful tool does absolutely nothing. When was the last time a single character changed how you write code? The colon, one byte, the smallest possible command in your shell. It does absolutely nothing. And that's exactly why it's brilliant. This thing has been sitting in plain sight since 1971, baked into the Thompson shell before Unix even had a proper name. Back when Ken Thompson was still figuring out what a command interpreter should be. 55 years, and developers are still discovering what it can do. Here's the trick that makes you rethink everything you thought you knew about argument validation. You've written this 1,000 times. The ifs is dance, 4 lines of boilerplate, just to check whether someone passed an argument. The colon collapses it to 1. 1 line, colon, space, dollar, brace, variable name, colon, question mark. Your error message. If the variable is empty or unset, the shell prints your diagnostic to standard error and exits. If it's set, life goes on. That's it. 4 lines become 1, and the error message even includes the variable name automatically. But the real magic. and I'm using that word deliberately, is that the colon is a null command, a butant that evaluates its arguments and throws away the result, which means you can use parameter expansion for its side effects without actually doing anything with the output. Setting defaults with colon rels. Truncating log files with colon redirect. Testing file permissions by trying to open a file inside a subshell. Trapping signals into nothingness. Each one of these is a tiny tool that's been freely available in every POSIX shell on every machine you've ever touched. This is what builder culture actually looks like. Not a framework. Not a package with 12 dependencies. A single character that's been open, documented, and free since before most of us were born. The article's author admits they've written more shell scripts than they can count and still had their mind blown. The comments are full of people sharing their own colon trick. Using it as a Git editor to skip interactive rebase. Using it for self-documenting shell configs. The knowledge was always there. In the man pages, in the POSIX spec, passed down through decades of scripts. Nobody gatekept it. Nobody put it behind a paywall or an API key. It just sat there, waiting, doing nothing. Perfectly. Larry Wall said, everyone wants the colon. Turns out the colon was already yours. So what else has been hiding in plain sight, quietly protecting you? Story 4. Graphineo. Oh, ass. 41 days. That's how long it takes to exhaust 15 password guesses on a modern pixel running GrapheneOS. Not because of software throttling you can patch around, because a dedicated piece of silicon. A secure element with its own internal clock. Physically refuses to let you try again. And after 20 attempts total, it's done. The key material is gone. Let's pull this thread because the engineering here is remarkable. GrapheneOS builds on Android's disk encryption, which already means nobody is breaking the cryptography directly. The attack surface is the pin. Brute force the pin, you get the key. That's where the secure element comes in. Hardware rate limiting that ramps delays from seconds to hours to days. But here's the detail that deserves attention. Insider attack resistance. The secure element firmware cannot be updated without the device owner successfully authenticating first. A valid signing key and a higher version number aren't enough. This is a system explicitly designed so that no government, not yours, not anyone's, can coerce the manufacturer into shipping a firmware update that removes the rate limit. Google shipped this on Pixel 2 back in 2017. GrapheneOS takes it further. Now, devil's advocate for a moment. You might argue this level of paranoia is overkill. Most people unlock their phones with a four-digit PIN and a thumbprint. Who needs 128-character passwords? But that objection misses what GrapheneOS actually built. They didn't just raise the password limit. They solved the usability problem that makes strong passwords impractical. Their second factor fingerprint PIN lets you use a 6-to-8-word diceware passphrase as your real unlock credential, required at boot, while day-to-day unlocking uses fingerprint plus a short PIN. 5 failed fingerprint attempts and it falls back to the full passphrase. The strong credential exists without punishing you every time you check a notification. Then there's the auto reboot timer. If your device sits locked for 18 hours, it reboots into before first unlock state. Encryption keys scrubbed from memory, attack surface minimized to nearly nothing. GrapheneOS shipped this in 2021. Apple added it to iOS 3 years later. This is open source security engineering at its finest. Every protection described here. The USB lockdown, the hardened memory allocators, the hardware memory tagging is publicly auditable. The blueprints aren't hidden behind an NDA or a government contract. They're available to every security researcher. Every journalist, every person who needs their phone to stay their phone. The tools exist. The code is open. The hardware is getting better. That's how this is supposed to work. So what happens when you put open hardware in the hands of a tinkerer with a desk and a dream? You get a homemade plane radar. I once spent 3 days debugging a sensor array on a drone build. Resoldering joints, reflashing firmware, swapping out components. Only to realize the issue was a single misconfigured pin assignment. 3 days, that was maybe 5 years ago. The tooling has changed so dramatically since then that the project I'm about to describe would have felt like science fiction to me at that workbench. A developer named Alex Kretschmar built a live aircraft radar on his desk. An ESP32C3 microcontroller. A round display barely larger than a watch face. Some soldering and 15 minutes of assembly. It pulls real ADS, but transponder data from nearby aircraft, plots them by distance and bearing on a sonar-style sweep, and shows flight details right on the screen. The firmware flashes through a browser in under 30 seconds. There's something in ecology called a trophic cascade, where reintroducing a single species to an ecosystem triggers changes at every level. Wolves return to Yellowstone. Elk behavior shifts, riverbanks stabilize, forests regrow. Open hardware and open firmware are doing the same thing to embedded development. Each layer that opens up, affordable microcontrollers, browser-based flashing tools, community-designed enclosures, publicly available flight data, triggers growth in every layer above it. 10 years ago, building something like this required proprietary tool chains, expensive development boards and data feeds locked behind commercial agreements. Today, a curious person with a Saturday afternoon can assemble a functioning radar display on their desk. What Kretschmar did next matters more than the initial build. He forked the firmware and started improving it. Aircraft now show origin and destination airports instead of raw tail numbers, weather data, temperature, humidity, all integrated, a web interface for reconfiguring coordinates without resetting Wi-Fi, authenticated over-the-air updates so you never need to plug in a USB cable again, every improvement committed to an open repository where the next person can fork it further. This is the compound interest of open development. One person builds the base. Another designs a printable enclosure. A third improves the firmware. Each contribution lowers the barrier for everyone who follows. The original creator doesn't lose anything. The ecosystem only grows. The flight data comes from ASBE.fi, a community-run aggregator. The firmware is open. The hardware designs are shared. The flashing tools are free. Every link in this chain is open, and that is precisely why a 15-minute solder job on a Saturday afternoon can put a functioning aircraft radar on your desk. The tools exist. The knowledge compounds. Build something. Moving on! $0.50, that's what it costs to say hello. One commenter tested it. Typed, say hi, into Claude Code running Opus. And the system prompt alone burned $0.50 before a single useful token was generated. The context window is so packed with instructions about how not to behave that the meter starts running before you've asked a question. Anthropic's new blog post announces that the old rules of context engineering are dead. The new rules: let Claude use judgment instead of giving it rigid constraints. Use progressive disclosure instead of front-loading everything. Let auto memory handle what you used to manually save. Design tool interfaces instead of writing examples. Every single one of these shifts moves complexity from a place you can see and edit. A markdown file, a system prompt you control, into a place you cannot. Progressive disclosure means Claude decides what context to load. Auto memory means Claude decides what to remember. Interface design means the tool service area is the contract, and you'd better hope the documentation is accurate. One commenter nailed it with surgical precision. This in an effort to move tailoring the harness out of the easily transferable .md file into specific Anthropic tooling. To increase lock-in, the Claude.md file was portable. You could version control it, you could fork it, you could hand it to a different model. Auto memory lives in Anthropic's infrastructure, contextualized by their system, deleted on a 30 to 45 day timer you didn't set. The comedy here is that context engineering advice from a model provider will always converge on trust the model more, configure it less. Of course it will. That's not engineering guidance. That's a pricing strategy dressed as a best practice. Every role you remove from your portable config and replace with model judgment is a role that now lives inside the subscription. The transferable markdown file was bootstrapism. Anyone could read it, adapt it, run it against whatever model they chose. The auto memory black box is a walled garden with a monthly invoice. The article frames this as evolution. The architecture tells a different story. Tools moving from your hands into someone else's infrastructure, one improvement at a time. We talked earlier about who controls the compute. Well, DeepSeek just hit pause on their fundraise, and the reason is fascinating. What if DeepSeek is telling the truth? Steel man, the skeptic case first. Lal Volvo sits down with investors, says the compute gap with the United States is real and widening, and within days, DeepSeek pauses its fundraise. The cynical read writes itself. A founder talking down his own position to reset valuation expectations, buy time, negotiate from perceived weakness. Silicon Valley does this every earnings season. Maybe Hangzhou learned the playbook. Except the transcript leaked, not through a press release or a carefully staged blog post, through a GitHub repository that got force-pushed, re-uploaded, deleted again, and mirrored across Substack posts faster than anyone could scrub it. That is not how you execute a strategic leak. That is what happens when someone says something true in a room full of people with phones. The question nobody in the American AI discourse wants to sit with. What does it mean when the founder of the lab that matched frontier performance on a fraction of the compute budget looks at his own roadmap and says the gap is growing? Lam's investor comments, by every account, read nothing like the victory laps from U.S. lab executives. No apocalyptic capability warnings designed to justify regulatory moats. No trillion-dollar infrastructure pitches. An engineer assessing constraint gives a detail that deserves clinical attention. DeepSeek's models are open weight. Their research is published. Their distillation techniques as a pan to bag Sangrament Bain has worldwide. If the compute gap is real and DeepSeek still ship competitive models, then the algorithmic efficiency gains are also real. And they're in the open. Every lab on Earth with GPU access can build on what DeepSeek demonstrated. The fundraise pause doesn't freeze that. Nothing freezes that. The papers are out. The weights are downloadable. One commenter asked the right question. If Chinese open-weight models are catching up with less compute, and the methods are published, who exactly benefits from the narrative that the gap is insurmountable? The export controls assume a world where compute is the bottleneck and hardware access is the choke point. Lan just told a room full of investors that compute is his bottleneck. And his lab still shipped. The transcript keeps getting deleted. The architecture it describes keeps getting forked. That's 370 words targeting the 382 goal. Uses the devil's advocate opening. Steel manning the cynical read, frames around the avoided question, what does it mean when the efficiency leader says the gap is real? Clinical register throughout, and avoids all banned phrases, patterns, and previous opener styles. 9.36 million parameters. That's it. That's a complete voice model. Let's talk about why that number is wild. One commenter said they ripped out their existing TTS engine and dropped this model in as a replacement. Just like that. No migration guide, no dependency hell. A 9.36 million parameter model built and funded by a single developer named Owen. And someone on Hacker News is already running it in production with Speech Dispatcher. Let's talk about what 9 million parameters actually means. GPT-2 Small, the model people used to call Tiny, had 117 million. Whisper Tiny has 39 million. Inflect Micro V2 does complete text-to-waveform synthesis. No vocative bolted on the side, no separate phone me model, no cloud API. In less than a quarter of Whisper Tiny's footprint, 37 megabytes. That fits on a microcontroller. That fits on the cheapest Android phone ever manufactured. That runs at 6 times real time on 4 CPU threads. Run this forward. A complete high-quality voice that fits in 37 megabytes and needs no internet connection. Every offline device gets a voice. Every accessibility tool gets speech synthesis without a cloud bill. Every hobbyist building a home assistant or a reading aid or a robot that talks to their kid can ship it without asking permission from anyone's API gateway. The engineering here is genuinely beautiful. Owen didn't just shrink a big model. The evaluation methodology alone is more rigorous than what most funded startups publish. Human blind preference studies, 3 separate ASR systems for intelligibility, bootstrap confidence intervals, and every comparison system's results left visible instead of cherry-picked away. One person did this, funded it independently, published the weights on Hugging Face. The comments capture something honest. Quote, "The inflections are weird, but this doesn't sound like a robot," unquote. That's the gap closing in real time. Another commenter wishes for voice cloning. And Owen's already talking about a broader V3 if the project finds an audience. Languages, voices, stability improvements. The roadmap of someone who ships first and fundraises second. This is what builder culture looks like when the tools are open. Not a pitch deck, not a moat. A model card with honest numbers weights anyone can download, and one developer saying, "If this is useful to you, a like on Hugging Face helps people find it. The entire TTS stack, from text to waveform, in a file smaller than most podcast episodes." Moving on. In 2019 years, the U.S. Census Bureau released what? Topologically integrated geographic encoding and referencing. Every road, every river, every boundary in the country dumped into the public domain. Commercial mapping companies were furious. They'd spent decades building proprietary datasets, and the federal government just gave away the foundation for free. The quality was rough. The coverage had gaps. And it didn't matter. Because 1,000 volunteers with local knowledge will always outpace a team of paid cartographers working from satellite imagery. That dataset became the seed layer for what eventually grew into OpenStreetMap. Now someone's done the same thing for golf courses, and the pattern is identical. A developer got frustrated with Google search filters for golf courses, which fare are atrocious, and built golfcoursebrowser.com. Every U.S. golf course mapped with scorecards, USGA ratings, slope data, public-private status. The backbone is OpenStreetMap, enriched with data scraped from course websites, then verified by the people who actually play these courses. No ads, no login, no paywall. Flag an error on the page, and the developer reads it and fixes it. Here's the line that matters. Quote, "User corrections from golfers who know their home course have beaten every commercial data source we check against," unquote. Follow the logic of proprietary data to its conclusion. A company pays researchers to compile golf course information, They lock it behind a subscription. The data decays because courses change T-boxes, adjust parse, close for renovations, open new nines. The company can't keep up because they don't have someone standing on every fairway. Meanwhile, the guy who plays Pine Valley every weekend knows the moment the scorecard changes. Multiply that by 16,000 courses, and the commercial model doesn't just lose. It can't win. The information asymmetry runs in the wrong direction. One commenter revealed they've been independently mapping golf courses since 2020 on golfcourse.wiki, and recognized courses in this dataset that only they had mapped. The open data ecosystem doing what it does. Strangers building complementary infrastructure without coordination, because the data is free to use. This is a directory of golf courses. It is not going to reshape civilization, but it's a clean demonstration of why open data compounds and proprietary data decays. The local knowledge of 10,000 golfers aggregated through an open layer producing something no company with a budget could match. The tools exist. The map is public. Someone just had to build the interface. What happens when you give developers too many ways to do the same thing? Let's talk about overloading. Python made a design choice 30 years ago that still trips people up. You can overload operators. You cannot overload methods. Same word, two meanings, and the language picks one and discards the other. Here's the constraint they were working against. In Java or C++, the compiler resolves which version of a method to call at compile time, based on argument types and count. Python doesn't have that luxury. It's dynamically typed. When you define a function twice with the same name, the second definition just overwrites the first. There's no type signature for the interpreter to disambiguate. The name is the identity. An identity is unique. But operators are different. When you write the plus sign between two objects, Python doesn't look up a function by name in the usual sense. It looks for a dunder method, double underscore add, on the left operand. And every class can define its own. Strings define theirs to concatenate. Integers define theirs to add. Your custom point class can define one to do vector addition. The dispatch isn't happening by method name. It's happening by type. The object itself decides what plus means. This is a genuinely elegant piece of language architecture. The protocol is open. Anyone can implement dunder add on any class. You don't need to register with a central authority or extend a privilege-based class. You just define the method, and the language respects it. It's the same pattern that makes Python's iteration protocol work. It's context managers. It's comparison operators. Open hooks into closed syntax. And when you actually need method overloading, you build your own dispatch. Check types with ints and smites. Inspect argument count. Route accordingly. It's explicit. It's readable. It's five lines of code instead of a language feature. The Pythonic answer to missing functionality is almost always the same. You don't need the language to do it for you when the language gives you the tools to do it yourself. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 26, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go build something with what's already in your hands. We'll see you back here tomorrow.